Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're this hour going to be talking about how we happen to be where we are. How did plant and animal species come to live where they live? How could species who are clearly distinct from each other, yet in the grand scheme of things very closely related, end up in far-flung places separated by wide stretches of ocean? Could it be that they may have made miraculous voyages across the world on their own? And don't you wish they could just speak and tell us all about it? This hour of the program, the author of The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. Our guest is Alan de Queiroz. He's an evolutionary biologist and adjunct faculty at the University of Nevada in Reno. He writes about biogeography, the evolution of behavior, and the origins of parasites. And the book has been getting really interesting, good reviews because it is such an interesting book. He's traveled all over the world, and the book starts where he and his then-girlfriend, she's now wife, are trying to pull a snake from a hole near the southern tip of Baja California. We'll get into that story and many others during the course of this hour. If along the way you would like to join us, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Hi, Alan. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So was this a thought, I mean, it's a pretty big thought, that just came to you fairly recently as you were dealing with that snake? Or have you, as a little kid, looked at the world and said, well, how did we get to be where we are? And other animals or plants got to be where they are. And I mean, were you thinking about this all the time?
Well, definitely not when I was a little kid. I know that. So, I mean, probably in graduate school or even as an undergraduate, I was at least exposed to these ideas. For instance, in The Origin of Species, Darwin talks about plants and animals dispersing to oceanic islands like Hawaii or the Galapagos.
Mm-hmm.
But what really got me into this, sort of looking into this in detail, was that garter snake in Baja, California. And I was actually studying the behavior of garter snakes at the time, so I wasn't thinking about this question of why things are where they are. But that garter snake, it's living in sort of near the tip of the peninsula of Baja California, whereas all the other populations of that same species are found in mainland Mexico, so to speak, across the Sea of Cortez.
Uh-huh.
So it was that particular example, actually, that got me thinking, like, well, how could that be? How did that snake get that strange distribution where part of some populations are in Baja California and others are separated from those by the Sea of Cortez? So that's really what got me interested in this question.
Yes, and your first thought must have been, well, heck, they don't really swim, do they?
Well, yeah, I mean, garter snakes, and these were actually somewhat aquatic garter snakes. In fact, they're pretty aquatic, but they're mostly in freshwater.
Oh.
So, you know, I wasn't thinking, at least at first, that they could easily swim across the Sea of Cortez. It was a distance of something like 120 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't looking like, at least not intuitively, a great explanation. And what people had thought before was that since Baja California at one time had been part of the peninsula, I mean, had been part of mainland Mexico, and then had rifted away through a plate tectonic process of rifting, it had moved away from the mainland and the Sea of Cortez had formed between.
Uh-huh.
So people had been thinking, well, that's what explained this distribution, that the snakes had just been there originally, and then they actually drifted with the peninsula as it formed and moved away from the mainland. So that was kind of the explanation at the time when I, you know, actually found those snakes down there. And that explanation turns out to be totally wrong, and it looks like the snakes really did get across the Sea of Cortez, probably not by swimming, probably either by rafting on a natural raft, or potentially just floating and drifting with the currents.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? Don't you wish they could just talk to you? Oh, man, what a story
yeah,
they would have.
would be nice if they could just tell us what happened.
Yeah, it sure would be. The other amazing thing to me is that you sure married the right woman, because I can't imagine, you know, going and having my boyfriend and I go to Baja California and try to take a snake out of the ground, you know?
Yeah. She was an incredibly good sport about it. She is a biologist, too, although she's a botanist. But, and she is a little bit afraid of snakes, so I give her a lot of credit for
helping
snakes down there.
Yeah, as you well should. You start your book with, I guess you love maps, and I'm sure many people in our audience do as well. But I'm interested in why you started the book with a map, and I loved your explanation of what this map is.
So the book starts with this. I was actually putting up this map of the world for our kids, kind of. Although, I mean, maybe it was really more for me than for the kids.
Yeah.
It's a map of the world that shows all these different animals and where they're found in the world. So, you know, it has elephants and giraffes in Africa and, you know, kiwi birds in New Zealand and tigers in Asia, et cetera. So, and I was just looking at that map, and it's very striking if you look at a map like that, that the faunas in different parts of the world are really distinct. Like, you know you're in Africa. If you see elephants running around and zebras and wildebeest, you know you're in Africa. You're not in North America or Asia or anything else, unless you're in a zoo, of course. So that's a very striking thing that comes out of any kind of a map like that, that things are really different in different parts of the world. But then there are these weird cases, too, where, like, so you look at the map and you see, well, actually, there are monkeys in Africa, and there are monkeys in South America, too.
Right.
And, you know, there are these big flightless birds called ratites, which include ostriches and kiwis, actually. And they're on practically all the southern land masses. So that seems kind of weird, too. They're not the identical species in all those different places, but they're, you know, parts of the same fairly closely related group of species.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that brings up this question of, you know, how could related species end up in these places that are separated by oceans? So that's kind of why I use that map as kind of a visual kind of lead in to what I was talking about, that you can just look at this and see, oh, look, monkeys in South America and monkeys in Africa.
Right.
And that leads into this whole question.
Yeah. I'd love to know where to get a map like that. I'd love to put it up somewhere in the house. It'd be great.
Yeah, there are quite a few of them like that, although the particular one I had was sort of hard to get a hold of, but there are quite a few maps like that. Oh, they're all made for kids, actually.
Yeah, that's okay. We're all kids. So have you come up with this, what you're talking about in this book, is it a radical idea? Will other scientists read this book and say, oh, my gosh, you're really out on a limb when you suggest that animals under their own power are hitching a ride on a raft or being blown by the wind may have gone from one continent to another. They traverse the oceans by themselves. Is this something that people said, well, that's unheard of until you?
No, not at all. So, I mean, but it is a complicated story.
All right.
So,
we got time.
It kind of starts with, it's not too complicated, but it kind of starts with Darwin. So, I mean, it actually goes even before Darwin and before people were thinking in evolutionary terms. But Darwin was clearly thinking about this. In fact, one of the things he was trying to argue against was that, in fact, you know, a very significant thing he was arguing against is that species have been created in different parts of the world, sort of created by God and placed in different parts of the world. So that would explain, you know, why there are all these native species in places like Hawaii or the Galapagos, even though those places have never been connected to continents, just because God put them there, basically.
Right.
And obviously Darwin didn't believe that, so he wanted to argue against that. And what he argued is that, well, actually, every once in a while, some, you know, organism actually makes a kind of a, you know, improbable journey out to one of those islands from a continent. And over millions and millions of years, that's how you build up these native species on islands. Right. So he was saying that, you know, these bizarre ocean journeys do happen, and it was actually a critical part of his argument for evolution. That he was saying you don't have to invoke God creating these species on oceanic islands, because you know, things can actually get there on their own. And then he did a bunch of experiments, especially with seeds, that were designed to show that this was at least possible, that seeds could survive, for instance, weeks or months in seawater and still be, and they'd still germinate at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of saying, you know, this is possible, that seeds at least can get out to islands. And then, you know, he'd go into things like rafting for animals or, you know, things hitching rides on bird feet and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And then when was the idea in vogue that we had this one continent, and is this indeed true, and then it split apart because of tectonic shifts and plates, and that's how all of this happened? Do we all agree, scientists, that we were one landmass at one point?
Yeah, so that's something that certainly today, you know, maybe I should modify that. All serious scientists or something like that. But basically, that's considered a fact that, you know, there were these supercontinents like Laurasia and Gondwana, and they broke up through continental drift. But that was something that really only became established in the 1960s because of evidence of seafloor spreading. You know, the evidence that there was magma coming up at oceanic ridges, and it was creating new ocean floor and in the process pushing apart continents,
mm-hmm.
right? So when that kind of evidence kind of came to light and validated plate tectonics, the mechanism for continental drift, then pretty much very quickly everybody agreed that that was true,
mm-hmm.
that the evidence was just really overwhelming. And what that did was it shifted for people who were thinking about where plants and animals and other living things are found on the planet. That provided this really neat, sort of elegant and global explanation for these weird distributions, like, you know, the rat-eyed birds on these different southern continents. Because what you could imagine then is that there was some ancestral, you know, and one of these big flightless birds, the ancestor of all the ones we see today, it was living on this supercontinent of Gondwana, you know, back in the Mesozoic era, the age of the dinosaurs. And when the continents broke apart, the descendants of that ancestral species just drifted with the continents.
Right.
Okay, so that provided this kind of really cool explanation for, you know, how these weird distributions came to be,
right.
Kind of an alternative to what Darwin had been saying with the ocean crossings.
But you can see the problem with that, because the continents don't really, if you put like Africa and South America together, they wouldn't be able to, you couldn't take the two pieces of the puzzle and put them together there. Could you?
They were together. So Africa and South America really were together.
They were.
Back, you know, 150 million years, or like even less than that, 100 million years ago or so. So all of these things, you know, the continents really were together. And all these different land masses that those rat-eyed birds, for instance, are now found on, they really were a part of this giant landmass of Gondwana, you know, back in the Mesozoic. But the question is, so that looks like this really nice explanation.
Right.
Or these weird distributions, but the question is it really the right explanation?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds great, and you know, almost immediately a lot of people were believing, oh, that's got to be the right explanation.
Mm-hmm. But you've seen, because of time, you've been able to see animals that had that kind of disperse in various parts of the world after that era, which would require another explanation.
Yeah, so time comes into this, because it turns out, and this is sort of the critical thing and kind of the thing that's changed people's minds over really about the last 15 or 20 years. So I'd say like 15 or 20 years ago, if you'd asked most people, you know, to explain something like the distribution of, say, monkeys and, you know, the fact that they're in South America and Africa, or the fact that there are these big rat-eyed birds on all those southern continents, most people immediately, biologists that is, immediately what they would have been thinking is, oh, that's because of continental drift, right? And that's certainly what I was thinking at the time,
right,
before I really started thinking about this very, very deeply and looking into the evidence that, you know, there are all these weird distributions, and most of them you can explain by continental drift.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so clearly that is what people were thinking. And then the timing information came in, because what it showed, and I can get into this more later, is that basically, especially through molecular data, but also through fossil data, it's actually sort of kind of both at once, but especially this kind of explosion of DNA sequence data that we've had in the last 20 years or so, it kind of lets you figure out how old different groups are. So, you know, it can put an age in millions of years on a group like the monkeys.
Uh-huh.
And so, for instance, in that case, it shows that monkeys as a group are, you know, on the order of 50 million years old or something like that. And what that shows is that, well, let's see, if monkeys are 50 million years old and South America and Africa split from each other 100 million years ago,
right,
then clearly the separation of South America and Africa has nothing to do with the separation of the monkeys.
Yes.
Because the monkeys weren't even there.
Uh-huh.
So they couldn't have drifted on the two land masses because there were no monkeys to drift, basically. And so it's that kind of information that's really coming from molecular DNA sequence data that has really changed the field and made people kind of accept many more of these ocean crossings than they were thinking had happened.
It is an incredible thing just to entertain, isn't it, that some monkeys crossed the ocean? That's a long ways.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is still, you know, kind of hard to fathom.
Right. So how
like, at the moment, the Atlantic is about 1,800 miles wide at its narrowest point. And back when the monkeys probably made this crossing, it was a lot narrower, but it was still about 900 miles wide or something like that.
Yeah.
So we're still talking about an incredibly sort of improbable journey in some sense.
So what did they do? How did they get there, do you think?
Well, so presumably in the case of monkeys, they rafted across, and not on a man-made raft, obviously, but on some sort of natural raft.
Uh-huh.
So often what happens on big rivers like the Congo or the Amazon, you'll get like chunks of the bank will break off, and they'll float in the river, and they'll often make it all the way down to the ocean. And then if they make it out into the ocean, they can actually be pushed by ocean currents way out into the ocean and potentially across, you know, an entire ocean. So the thought is that, you know, that, I mean, this happens all the time, actually, and most of the time there are obviously no monkeys on those rafts. And even if there are, lots of times, you know, again, most of the time, the raft isn't going to make it across the whole ocean.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, once in some, you know, many millions of years, maybe one of these things with monkeys is going to make it across the ocean and make it across quickly enough so that the monkeys are alive on the other end. And that's sort of what we're imagining happened in this case.
Yeah. How long would that take, do you think?
Well, there's sort of different estimates. The sort of most, the quickest estimate is actually on the order of about 10 days for the Atlantic at the time the monkeys did it. So again, it's a much narrower Atlantic.
Yeah.
But, you know, based on the speed of ocean currents and wind, you know, potentially pushing against vegetation on the raft. I actually think that estimate is probably too low, that it's probably more like several weeks, you know, at a minimum. So it's still something that it's very unlikely. You know, it's something that is not going to happen very often because, you know, several weeks, you know, is a long time for a monkey to survive on a raft. There's got to be enough food and water
right,
on the raft somehow for them to survive.
Yeah. So why would it be important to know this, to know that this indeed happened? What does it tell us?
Well, I think in sort of the most basic sense, what it tells us is that, let me back up for a second. So it's clearly an important aspect of the history of life.
Mm.
So these things have happened often enough and have had big enough effects that, for instance, if you could go back and somehow eliminate all these weird ocean voyages, the Earth would be a radically different place. So it would have really different kinds of organisms. There would be a lot of things would not exist that we are familiar with. For instance, there would be no monkeys in South America. And at the moment, there are, you know, something like 130 species of monkeys in South America.
Goodness.
And, yeah, I mean, anyone who, you know, goes to South America and gets out into wild places much at all, you know, you're definitely going to see monkeys down there, mm-hmm. howler monkeys and spider monkeys, et cetera. So monkeys just wouldn't be there if not for one of these weird ocean journeys. And that's true of a whole bunch of other groups, too. So South America is actually a very nice example of that, because it turns out that most of the mammal species of South America are descended from an ancestor that crossed an ocean or sea to get there.
Oh, my, really?
Yeah, so you know, there are these big rodents called capybaras, and they're related to guinea pigs, which are another South American rodent. And they're part of this big group of South American rodents that are all descended from an ancestor that, like the monkeys, apparently crossed the Atlantic. And then there's another rodent group that probably came from North America across the Caribbean. It turns out that, you know, well over half the species of mammals in South America are derived from these weird ocean voyages. And, you know, the same thing is probably true for most other parts of the world, too, that there are huge groups of organisms that definitely would not be there if they hadn't made one of these fluky journeys.
Yeah, and it's not just mammals, it's plants too, right, and insects?
Yeah, well, plants even more so, than because plants are pretty good at doing this, because in the seed stage, seeds are kind of like propagules that are in suspended animation. So they're really good. They're sort of, you know, not, I mean, in a sense, they're kind of pre-adapted, or I don't know what's the right word. But anyway, they're sort of very good at making these long ocean voyages and surviving when they get to the other end. So plants have done this countless times.
Mm-hmm.
So again, with South America, there are probably literally thousands upon thousands of plant species that wouldn't be there if their ancestors hadn't crossed an ocean to get there.
Wow. Oh, it's amazing to think about them making a journey, isn't it? Our guest this hour is the author of The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. And we're welcoming phone calls for Alan DeCasidos. He is an evolutionary biologist, adjunct faculty at the University of Nevada in Reno. And he writes about all kinds of topics: biogeography, the evolution of behavior, the origins of parasites. And this book is about those improbable journeys that shaped the way the Earth is right now. Here's how you reach our conversation if you would like to. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Alan DeCasidos is with us now in the book we're talking about, The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. Mary in Madison, our first caller for you. Alan, hi, Mary.
Hello. Could he please explain the sequence? At one time, there was one large continent, and then it broke apart. And there was another event, and I don't know continents having different, being in different places than present. And I don't know which came first. And also, would a factor such as shallow seas make transportation more easy?
The first question about the sequence of kind of the breakup of the continents. So I don't know if I want to go through that in detail, but there was this, at one time, all of the continents that we know now were together as this giant continent of Pangaea. So both in the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere continents. And those broke up into a giant northern continent called Laurasia and a giant southern continent called Gondwana. And actually, the focus of my book is probably more on Gondwana, because that's actually been the focus of biogeographers, the people who study these, you know, the distribution of organisms, are at least more so than Laurasia. So Gondwana included South America, Africa, Australia. It actually included India also. So India actually was part of Gondwana and then broke off and ended up as part of the northern continents, but that's sort of a different story. But it also included then Madagascar, New Zealand, you know, New Guinea, which was part of Australia, basically. So all of those bits, kind of all the major land masses of the southern hemisphere, were together in this large supercontinent of Gondwana. And then about 150 million years ago, Gondwana started breaking up, although it took, you know, about 100 million years for that process. I mean, in a sense, it's still going on. But so it took about 100 million years before you get kind of the configuration of the continents more or less as you see them today in the southern hemisphere. So I don't know, does that answer your question?
But wasn't there another event before that?
Certainly. So, I mean, if you keep going back, there, you know, this process of plate tectonics, which is a geological mechanism for continental drift, seafloor spreading, that's been going on, you know, for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. So even far before Pangaea was formed, that process was going on. And there were other continents before that. So, yeah, but most of those are not really relevant, at least to the examples I'm talking about in the book, because they're sort of so long ago that they couldn't possibly have affected things like mammals or birds.
Mm. Thank you, Mary. And we go to another Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm fascinated. What an interesting program. I want to know if everything went from Africa to South America. Was there anything that went the other way? I mean, do the currents go one way?
That's a great question, actually.
Thanks, Mary. That is a good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it turns out that, at least for vertebrates, virtually every instance of a land vertebrate crossing the Atlantic is from Africa to South America rather than the other way around. And it's thought that that's because the currents are more conducive to that Africa to South America voyage than the other way. And it's partly, there actually are currents that go both ways, but the way the currents are sort of like the placement of the currents, it's much easier to catch a current near the African coast that'll take you all the way across to South America than it is to catch a current near the South American coast going the other way. Hmm. So that's probably the explanation for why, you know, almost all these voyages have gone one way. And most of those examples, by the way, are lizards and snakes. So there's a couple others. There's the monkeys, the rodents, you know, this one group of rodents that led to the guinea pigs. There's actually a weird bird example, this bird called the Hoatzin that lives in South America. And it's this group of that the Hoatzin is part of. They were probably all really weak flying birds, so they probably could not have flown across the Atlantic, so they probably rafted across just like the lizards and monkeys and things. But again, in that case, it's a little unclear which way it went, but it probably, again, was Africa to South America. So, yeah, that's a great question, and it probably does have to do with the sort of placement of ocean currents.
Otherwise, we could have imagined all kinds of different animals in different places, right? Your imagination goes another way. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going off on something completely different after that, so please go ahead.
Yeah, it brings up an interesting point, which is that, so these weird things do happen, but, you know, if you look at kind of, there are patterns within the weirdness, so to speak. So it kind of, on one level, it looks very chaotic and random that these things are just making these very unusual journeys across oceans. But then if you look at sort of everything that's done this, or everything that think we know did this, you see these patterns, like the fact that almost all the Atlantic crossings go in one direction. And, you know, the same thing is There are some other patterns like that that go in the direction of ocean currents.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's a case with Madagascar where the ocean currents actually changed direction. And in that case, what it looks like was at one time it was pretty easy to get to Madagascar from Africa for things to raft across. But then the ocean currents changed. And once they changed, then it became really difficult. And what happens is that, you know, once the ocean currents change, then you don't see that happening anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a great question, actually.
What about the effect of salt? I know that Darwin was concerned about this, and I would think that it would be difficult for animals to be in salt or have salt surrounding them, and certainly seeds that were going these long distances. Wouldn't they be damaged by the salt in the oceans?
Yeah, that's another good question. And in fact, a lot of seeds probably a lot of seeds are damaged by salt. So, you know, a lot of seeds wouldn't be able to do this, at least. I mean, they could still maybe do it if they're on a raft that doesn't get inundated with water.
Oh.
So then, you know, they don't have to deal, although maybe they're still dealing with salt spray, so even then they might be killed. But it turns out that, you know, starting with Darwin, who did these experiments with immersing seeds in seawater, people have shown, you know, many times that actually a lot of seeds can survive that immersion in salt water. And some of them even seem to be designed to be transported in salt water. So things like coconuts seem to be actually adapted for being dispersed by floating in the ocean. So, but it's clearly something that, you know, some plants are better at doing that than others because
yes,
their seeds are not affected by salt water or not affected so quickly.
Let's go to a couple emails. Pete in Madison, I was wondering if you have given any consideration and legitimacy to the possibility of lost continents or islands, specifically in the Atlantic, that could have assisted these animals.
Yeah, so actually, in the case of the monkeys, one of the things that's come up is that back at the time when people think the monkeys made this crossing about 40 million years ago, or about then, there probably were quite a few more islands in the Atlantic, especially the South Atlantic. They weren't huge islands, but you know, there were a lot more islands, it looks like, back then. And so the monkeys potentially could have used those as stepping stones. So, I mean, it still would be, you know, a very difficult journey because, you know, the monkeys would have had to make a rafting journey to one island, then to the next island, et cetera, et cetera. So it's still a pretty amazing thing. But that's it would have made it so that they wouldn't necessarily have had to make the crossing all in one shot. So because there were these bigger islands within the Atlantic at the time,
mm-hmm,
more islands. Yeah, so that's a great point. And that's true for a lot of other places, too, that, you know, the configuration of islands is different now than it used to be. In some places, there are more islands now than there used to be. In other places, there are fewer. And that clearly has some kind of an effect on how things can disperse.
Mm-hmm. Larry in Appleton, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have I had one question I called for, and then your comment, I have another question about the coconut seeds that you say are designed or adapted to salt water. Is that because they'd be too heavy in regular water?
I assume that coconuts will float in fresh water too, but so if you look at the distribution of coconuts, though, they're, you know, and coconuts are often these beach, you know, they're growing right on the beach basically, and then they're spread, you know, in over many different islands in the Pacific, for instance. So I can't say that I actually know a lot about that particular example, but I know that people think that, you know, that there's been selection for coconuts to be able to float long distances in water. And usually,
okay,
I think what they're floating in is the ocean. Yeah, they probably,
okay,
float in fresh water too, but yeah.
All right. My more philosophical question is a result of my frustration with potential presidential candidate Ben Carson, who doesn't believe in evolution, and it relates to your discussion about the. In my mind, it should relate, or I think it might help for him and other deniers to recognize how well to know that as a kid I noticed the how Africa and South America would fit nicely together. And it never occurred to me that that may have happened until I heard about the tectonic plates, and then it made perfect sense to me. And the key to understanding that or to comprehending it is to be able to accept the long, many, many, many years that it takes, and likewise in evolution, I think the difficulty that the, that is prevalent is that people don't comprehend the what a million years or millions of years can do to a process, or can engage in, especially the chaotic, what appears to be a chaotic process, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so that's exactly right, and on both counts, for both the continents and for evolution. That I mean, you know, if you think that the Earth is only 4,000 years old or something like that, then both the continental drift and evolution become very implausible theories. Okay, so you really, you have to accept the notion of so-called deep time, that the Earth is actually, you know, many millions of years old. And so, and getting back to, like, the monkey example, so again, it's something that in any one year, or even any, you know, thousand years, the chances of a monkey crossing the Atlantic on a natural raft are virtually nil.
Right.
But monkeys have been around for 50 million years. So the probability becomes, you know, much greater when you're talking about that amount of time. And that's really, the caller said, that's really a key to understanding this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a key to understanding, you know, why there are all these native species in Hawaii. You know, it's because Hawaii has been around for millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Hawaii had only been around for a few thousand years, you know, there's no way that all of those things would have gotten out there naturally. So that is really a key point.
So it would be virtually impossible for us to track something that might be happening now?
And in the book, you know, all these examples I talk about in the book, like the monkeys or, you know, the lizards crossing the Atlantic or whatever, It's not as if you actually ever see these. Well, I shouldn't say ever. Very occasionally you see these things happening, but not very often. Okay, so nobody's ever actually seen a raft with monkeys out
no.
of the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah,
but that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So it's more like you have to think about, okay, what could possibly happen? What's plausible? And then when you take into account the incredibly long history over which this could have happened, that's when it starts becoming much more reasonable to think about these things.
More phone calls momentarily. Our guest, the author of, you can tell now after listening to him for some time, the fascinating book, The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shaped the History of Life. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Essentially, the book is about how animals and plants, in fact, made miraculous voyages across the world on their own. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for our guest, Ellen DeCatos and Tom in La Crosse. Hello, Tom.
Hello. I understand the 50 million years versus 100 million for the drift of the continents and the DNA, but why were all the monkeys on the African side of the split? Was there? Do you know to understand the topography of Gondwana?
Well, that just has to do basically with where a monkey's originated. So, you know, I mean, normally a particular group, if you go back far enough in time, they will have originated on some particular landmass, right? So it just happens that the monkey is originated in the old world, In fact, it looks like it's looking like monkeys actually probably originated in Asia and then got over to Africa at some later time. But really, it just boils down to that: is that, you know, particular groups originate in specific places, and it just happens that the monkeys originated and first kind of diversified in the Old World, and then this one species, presumably just one species, rafted across to the New World.
Are there any species from South America that originated there and have made it back?
I'm trying to think. There are some plants, which I don't think I'll be able to think of the names of them off the top of my head. I'm more of an animal person than a plant person. But, yeah, there are some plants that originated in South America and have made it over to Africa, actually. Hmm. I'm not aware of any land vertebrates that have done that, that originated in South America and went to Africa. But there are certainly quite a few plant groups that did that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the call. 800-486-8655. I know you've done a lot of traveling, and your description of New Zealand probably would make all listeners want to go to New Zealand because of all that's there. You must be so struck every single day, Ellen, by the extraordinary diversity of mammal life and plant life on this planet. It is something, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is something. It's pretty amazing. And one of the things that also comes out of thinking about these weird kind of ocean crossings is that the diversity is likely a lot greater because of these things. So if you think about, well, oceanic islands are the most obvious case, where oceanic islands would basically be just barren in terms of land organisms if it hadn't been for these, you know, few colonists that had been able to get there. So places like Hawaii, which were originally just, you know, just a lump of lava, if nothing had been able to get out there,
it'd
still be lumps of lava, and well, until people got there and brought things. But so that's the most obvious case. But again, thinking about South America with all these different rodents and monkeys that are there, you know, these ocean crossings have probably added a lot to the diversity of life on the planet.
We'll go next to Carol in Oak Creek. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering why monkeys in South America have tails, but monkeys in Africa do not have tails.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, that's a good question. So African monkeys, a lot of them do have tails, most of them, but they'd never use the tails as this kind of a fifth limb where they actually can wrap around a branch with it and use that as they're moving through the trees. And not all South American monkeys do that, but some of them do. And, I mean, there's an interesting distinction between the African monkeys and the South American ones in the sense that I believe that all South American monkeys are pretty arboreal. That is, they're mostly living in the trees. Right, whereas there are a lot of African monkeys, like baboons, and a lot of the great apes, which are basically monkeys, you know, and including us, we're African monkeys in a sense. So there are a lot of African monkeys that live a lot of the time on the ground, and those species clearly don't need the tail to use, or it's less likely that they would evolve a tail as this fifth limb to use for moving around in the trees. But as to exactly why that happened, like how that came to be in the South American monkeys that do have that, I'm not really sure. But it looks like something that's kind of an adaptation for a highly arboreal, that is, tree-living lifestyle.
Mm. Thanks, Carol. Maggie, Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I'm a total believer in evolution, but I actually have a question regarding this whole theory. I'm wondering, given how hard a journey floating across the ocean would be, what are the odds of a species such as monkeys having enough members survive a journey to actually be able to proliferate as a species once they reach the new landmass, especially given the small number of babies that monkeys usually have at a time?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And so just getting across the ocean, in a sense, is only a small part of this. So probably a lot of things have been able to make it across an ocean, but then it's such a small population to begin with that the likely fate of most of those little populations is that they're just going to blink out. Either they're not going to find a suitable place to live, or even if they do, just by chance, they're not going to survive, and they're certainly not going to lead to some major group like the South American monkeys. So that's the great thing to sort of think about, is that just getting across the ocean is not the end of the story. You have to then establish yourself on the other side. And one of the things that's actually come up for people reading this book, I've got some feedback about this, is that some people question whether a small group would ever survive. You know, so let's say it's, you know, 5 or 10 monkeys reach the South American coast. Some people have this idea that, well, they're going to have to be breeding with their own relatives, and there's not going to be enough genetic variation, so the population is just going to be doomed genetically, in a sense. And the sort of most obvious response to that is, we know that that doesn't always happen. That we know that tiny populations like that can survive and thrive. And the reason we know that is because we've introduced really small populations to places all over the world, actually. And usually what happens is they go extinct. But in many cases, they've actually proliferated greatly and thrived and even become serious pests. So one of the most striking examples is muskrats, which were 5 muskrats were introduced to Europe. I'm trying to remember, this was about 100 years ago or so. And now there are literally millions of muskrats.
Really?
And they're a serious pest, actually. So that kind of founding, that tiny founding group of muskrats, is sort of the equivalent of, to what I'm imagining anyway, of the founding group of monkeys that made it to South America, or of rodents making it to South America. But that's actually a great question, because it's a serious issue that comes up all the time with what's going to happen to a very small population that crosses an ocean.
Right. Thank you, Maggie, for the call. Michael in Madison, hi.
Hi. There is a historical report by Joshua Slocum, the first man to go sailing single-handedly around the world. He saw a raft of monkeys, including maybe some trees and whatever. It was probably like a bog from a river delta or something. I'm pretty sure it was like in the South China Seas or someplace in that jumble of land and water, you know, Indonesia area. That's Joshua Slocum single-handedly sailing around the world. He has an account of it, which sailors love.
Oh, Joshua.
I'll have to write that down. Joshua Slocum. I haven't heard of that.
S-L-O-C-U-M. Joshua Slocum, and it was around 1900 or just before, and he made a well-publicized solo sail around the world, and I'm pretty sure it was he who reported seeing a floating island. It had to be like a delta bog, you know what I'm saying? With lots of vegetation on it, and he reported a number of monkeys on there. And I always thought, boy, would that ever be a great explanation for how people got to Australia before they were supposed to have navigational, technology or kind of out of sequence with what we would expect, because people got to Australia so long ago.
Actually, the Australian case is one I've been wondering about myself. I've been, reading a little bit about that. And, so people... And the monkey example is great, too, by the way, and I'll have to look that up.
It sure is. I love our listeners on this hour. It's really great. Thanks, Michael. Final question I'll ask. We don't have time to take the call. How big were the rafts carrying the animals? Do we know?
No, we don't know, although sometimes these rafts are really, really huge. And one case I remember, it was a raft that was estimated to be about 900 square feet in area, and it had 30-foot-tall trees growing on it. And that raft was actually seen off the northeast coast of the United States at one point. And then a couple months later, it was seen about 1,200 miles away, closer to Europe.
Whoa.
So these things are potentially pretty big. And that's certainly not the maximum size for a natural raft. So that's another thing is, you don't have to imagine this tiny little raft that the monkeys are barely sitting on. You know, it could be a very large sort of floating island, so to speak, out there in the ocean.
Well, this has just been a fascinating hour. I'm sure your life is as well. It must be really interesting for you to see the world every day, right?
Yeah, no, I think it does kind of change your perspective on things. When, like going to New Zealand, I think if I'd gone to New Zealand 20 years ago, I would have just been thinking about Gondwana. which is a fascinating story in itself.
Right.
You know, the breakup of Gondwana. But now going there, I mean, I went there about 7 years ago,
uh-huh.
and then I was thinking, wow, like a lot of this stuff got here by crossing oceans. Which, again, is, you know, it's fascinating to think
it
that.
It is. Yeah, thank you
kind,
so much.
It kind of illustrates sort of the flukiness of life, I think.
Right. Thanks, Alan. Thanks so much. The book is The Monkey's Voyage, How Improbable Journeys Shape the History of Life. Alan DeCatos, our guest this hour. And thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show and to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production.